The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.
1 minute until ignition. 1 minute.
You're hearing the sounds of a warehouse being set on fire.
Could I get a radio check?
It's not an emergency, just a simulation.
And radio check.
Thank you.
Insurance companies are staging not just fires, but wreckage of all kinds to better understand how companies can protect themselves.
3, 2, 1. It's in your hands.
Go!
Got your go. Taking data.
What they don't tell you in those action films with burning buildings, earthquakes, and blown up cars is they all have one thing in common: insurance.
In modern human history, man has innovated.
Jeffrey Rogo is the investing editor for the Wall Street Journal.
He's created ships and rail, cars, but none of these would find their ways into human hands if we hadn't created a way to insure these products.
He's at one of the nation's busiest transportation hubs, just outside the Holland Tunnel, which connects New Jersey with the island of Manhattan.
The same thing is going to happen now as myriad new technologies find their way from Silicon Valley to your living room, dining room, home, car, and everything else.
And this process of creation and innovation actually dates back hundreds of years.
Since the 1600s, when the first ships came to the New World from Europe, they needed to figure out, what are the likelihood those boats are going to crash? How do we create products so that other people can mitigate the risks of those boats running into an issue?
The same principles apply, but with new twists.
Talk about an Uber car. It picks up a passenger, it takes him to his next stop, and it has an insurance for that part of the ride. But once you're dropped off, the insurance company does not insure the vehicle anymore. It goes from being a professional car to a passenger car.
And pretty soon, companies will have to figure out how to insure cars without drivers.
The question with that is, who insures them? Is it you, the driver? Is it the car manufacturer? Is it the technology company? What about cyber insurance? What if that car gets hacked? And even if we have the perfect technology to make driverless cars work, you will never see a driverless car on the road unless insurance companies have figured out a way to insure that vehicle.
This episode, we're not talking about the future of insurance.
We're talking about how you insure the future of everything.
This is The Future of Everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal.
From the newsroom in New York, I'm Jennifer Strong, and this is The Future of Everything.
We say that at Lloyd's we underwrite human progress, and my team is part of that.
Trevor Maynard is the head of innovation at Lloyd's of London, the world's oldest insurance marketplace. It's where insurance buyers and sellers come together.
So Lloyd's started out 327 years ago by a man called Edward Lloyd, who was running a coffee shop.
Merchants would gather in the coffee house and talk about shipping voyages around the world.
These were quite dangerous events, so people would talk about the risks and people would offer to share in the risks of those journeys.
It's how insurance was born.
Edward Lloyd himself would make information available in terms of shipping movements and ships that arrived safely or not, and this caught on, and so people kept coming to Lloyd's as a sort of centre for insurance in London.
Underwriters at Lloyd's wrote the first car insurance policy.
This was building on our shipping experience, so it was actually described as a ship operating on land.
And they've applied the same ideas to space travel.
1965, we saw the first satellite being insured at Lloyd's. And now, actually, we're insuring Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic private spaceship. So we're right at the forefront of that new market in space travel. So because we're large and well diversified, we can actually take on these risks, even though there is uncertainty. And in fact, we have an appetite to do that at Lloyd's. One of the jobs of my team is to produce emerging risk reports, where we horizon scan and we come up with a risk and then we explore it.
Including that question about who's responsible for an accident in a driverless car.
This is yet to be fully determined. you know, if you can imagine in sort of 15 years' time, the person behind the wheel, well, there won't be a wheel for a start, and also they may not even know how to drive. You know, this could be a 19-year-old that has never learnt to drive. They've leased the car to take them from A to B. I wouldn't imagine it was possible to hold them liable for it. So then the question is, well, who is?
Insurance policies are built on huge data sets gathered over long periods of time. So when a risk isn't yet a reality, underwriters have to get creative.
And often what we'll do is come up with a scenario where we try to say to people, this is a plausible but extreme event in that situation.
Such as how much a theoretical cyber attack could cost a large tech-reliant business. They also look at real events and how they could have been worse.
It's called counterfactual risk analysis, and we think it's a very interesting way of filling in the blanks when you're missing the data. So an example might be the recent near miss between some aircraft in San Francisco Airport, where an Air Canada flight was coming in to land, and it unfortunately was misaligned, and it was aiming at the taxi lane rather than the runway, and it pulled up with about 58 feet to spare. And it was 5 seconds away, we believe, from hitting a third plane and possibly a fourth, and it could have been a very bad aviation incident.
Counterfactual risk analysis follows those what-ifs.
What's the chance of that plane actually hitting them? Could it have hit more planes? How many people were on board?
And examines what could have made something a bigger deal than it was.
The other way of doing this is by building models. If the thing you're doing is amenable to the laws of physics, you can actually do quite scientific models.
Those models can be used to imagine thousands of hypothetical storms.
And then we can take those simulated storms and work out how much we would lose based on engineering understanding, based on science, and also just expert judgment. And then a fast feedback loop to make sure you learn from when you got it wrong. So that's the kind of gold standard in modelling, where you've got the laws of physics and they're filling up the missing data for you.
Innovation has always kept the insurance business on its toes, but Maynard says the rapid pace now is different.
I do believe today really is different, which is exciting. 100 years ago, things like the telephone, electricity, they took about 40 years for a big chunk of society to accept them. Now you're looking at sort of 6-7 years, and they've been taken on board by a big chunk of society. So therefore, businesses have to continually reinvent themselves for different groups of customers that will be using these new technologies and will expect to be served via those technologies. And therefore, from an insurance perspective, we have to think how the risks are evolving.
I'm Leila Kaderi. I head up enterprise risk at Tokio Marine Kiln, a syndicate at Lloyd's,
which underwrites cyber policies.
So the risks that our insureds face today are substantially different. For example, reliance on computer systems, reliance and storage of data in a different way, the analysing of big data, all of those new processes and the way we do business has changed their risk landscape. And insurance has had to adapt to cater for those new risks. It's not so much a question of what technology you're using, but what would your loss be if that technology failed?
And with cybercrime on the rise,
our large insureds get attacked hundreds of times a day.
Reputational damage is a big concern, especially when it comes to private data.
For example, names and email addresses being breached. Customers, they can kind of live with that one. We see less anger from the customer base if it's fairly benign data that goes missing. But if it's sensitive healthcare information, people get a lot more upset. They don't want that leaked out into the public, and they are likely to leave a company as a result of it.
So how do you ensure the reputation of a company?
We are simply putting them back in the financial position they would have been in had that event not been publicized in the media and had they not lost customers.
But unlike cars or even natural disasters, there just isn't that much data yet.
We haven't had the cyber equivalent of, say, Hurricane Katrina. It just hasn't happened. So the pricing is based off estimated underwriter judgment rather than a lot of the insurance industry, which is based off actuarial scientific judgment. So we really look at all the different threat vectors and what the likelihood is of attack, as well as what the severity of it is, and we generate estimated maximum losses based on what is possible, what's plausible, but hasn't necessarily happened.
My name is Nicole Friedman, and I write about insurance for the Wall Street Journal.
People joke with me a lot in the insurance industry. They say, oh, how did you end up with insurance? Like, it's a bad thing, or like, it's really boring. And why would anyone want to write about insurance? But the thing about insurance is it's just risk and fear. And those things are fascinating. And insurance allows people to take bigger risks, kind of offloads that risk. And it says, okay, we'll protect you if something catastrophic happens. And so that enables companies or individuals to do things that are new or that are unusual.
Companies are figuring out how to insure all sorts of new business models. Uber's a good example, but just the tip of the iceberg.
How do you cover satellites and rockets and companies that are exploring space? And how do you cover new types of construction or the sharing economy if people own homes, but then they also use their homes as businesses and rent them out on websites like Airbnb? Is that a good risk for a traditional home insurance policy, or should there be a new policy that specifically covers that type of in-between personal and business use?
The goal is to customize insurance so it better fits with the real risk. But in a period of such rapid change, the degree of risk is also a moving target, such as in warehouses.
One of the innovations that we've seen lately is we're seeing boxes get much, much more tightly packed together because now a lot of facilities have robots moving the boxes around instead of humans, so the robots don't need quite as much room to maneuver.
What might that mean in a warehouse fire? One way to find out is to start one.
30 seconds until ignition.
FM Global is a mutual insurance company. That means it's owned entirely by its policyholders. We took a field trip to the company's test center in Rhode Island.
Next thing you hear, be a go. Go!
Got your go. Taking data.
So what they had set up in this lab was two identical shelving units that looked like they should be in a warehouse, and one was underneath a sprinkler system and one was not.
And sprinkler activation at 54 seconds.
If one cardboard box catches fire, how quickly will that spread to all the other boxes? How quickly will that spread to the ceiling? And how does that compare if there's some sort of a fire to the types of risks that we've seen in the past?
Max temp above the northern array at 1300, 1 minute remaining in the test.
I got to stand on the floor of this enormous warehouse where they lit these two giant towers of shelving on fire and got to stand pretty close. It was kind of terrifying. And the fire just licked right up the shelves and grew from one cardboard box to all the way, the whole shelving unit. It was probably about 20 boxes in each one. And then you saw on the left side, the sprinklers came on and the fire was pretty quickly put out by the sprinkler system. But in the other side where there was no sprinkler system, the fire just grew and grew and got hotter and hotter. And you're seeing sparks flying off. And then at one point, my kind of guardian, the tour guide that I was there with, who was making sure I was safe, said, okay, now you have to run. And I kind of turned and ran away because the smoke was billowing out and it was unsafe to be there. So we kind of left the room, went into a side room, and that's when the firefighters came in and put it out.
And 3, 2, 1, test is over. 3 minutes, 30 seconds.
I'm Leslie Sism with the Wall Street Journal. We are sitting outside the New York headquarters of Marsh & McLennan, which is one of the world's biggest insurance brokers. A broker is a middleman between the policyholders, the businesses that need insurance, and the insurance companies that sell it. They play a very important role in figuring out if we need new insurance products.
Products such as cyber policies. She says brokers help decide what's needed and how it should work.
It was tough getting started because they really didn't have any data to work with. You know, when you think about car insurance, these companies have decades of automobile wreck data that they can work on to determine what prices to charge. They need to get the products in the hands of the customers, and they actually kind of want some claims to come in the beginning because they've got to figure out if they have a product that the businesses can use. On the other hand, the insurance companies don't want policy language so loose that they're gonna send a lot more money out the door in payments on these claims than they ever intended to.
But these policies are changing because cybercrime is changing.
the first generation of policies mostly focused on the costs that retailers and healthcare companies incur when there are hacks and private data is tapped into, is obtained by the hackers. Now there's much more risk that the criminals will disrupt operations. They're not just after data anymore. They're now into creating chaos or havoc or trying to block operations in exchange for some ransom payment.
And so companies are teaming up with specialty firms that deal in cyber risk to try to catch holes in cybersecurity before hackers do.
These firms can come in and stress test the business's networks and figure out where they have vulnerabilities so they can sort of try to hack the businesses themselves and figure out if these insurance policyholders are going to have problems.
And with more and more companies relying heavily on hackable technology for their day-to-day operations, she says cyber risk can get expensive fast.
So this is the newest front for the insurance industry. They're trying to limit the amount of insurance they're selling. They're sort of in this stage of perfecting the product.
And while insurers are paid to protect their clients, they also have to protect themselves.
They make sure that they don't sell too much insurance to any particular client. So they're capping the amounts of cyber risk insurance at much lower levels now than they do for things like property insurance. One of the senior Marsh & McLennan brokers was telling me this market basically started in the 1990s. And in the early years, there was about $20 to $30 million in annual premium for cyber risk policies. And there were just a handful of insurance carriers that were selling these policies. Today, the market has grown to dozens of insurance companies selling various kinds of cyber risk policies. And premium volume for 2017 is expected to exceed $3 billion. So there's been some tremendous growth here. But I'll just tell you, it still remains a pretty small line of business. Car insurance is about a $200 billion business. So there's a lot of room for growth. But insurance companies are nervous about just rapidly expanding because there's still so much they don't know about cyber risk. And cyber risk itself is so rapidly evolving.
But new technologies aren't just changing the way everyone else does business or the types of policies they need. They're changing the way insurance companies work, too.
Patrick Key, Vice President of Travelers Claims.
Travelers is the second largest writer of property insurance in the country. Key and his colleague Ben Johns are taking me on a tour of their giant training facility called Claim University in Windsor, Connecticut. It's where Travelers trains its staff how to assess damage of all kinds. But first, they have to simulate that damage.
Hi, I'm Ben Johns. So you're in the property lab right now. Within the property lab, we have two freestanding homes. The one you're looking at right now is our tri-level home. It's about 1,800 square feet. And the other home over there is our ranch home, and that's about 1,200 square feet. And both homes are fully furnished. They're fully outfitted. They're fully functional. So the exercises we can have here are really great. We can look at external damage. We can go inside the homes. We can look at plumbing, electricity. So you can see over in the corner, we have the lawnmower that's been put away. It's hot. It's got accelerants, oil, and gas. It was tucked away in a corner quickly. Garage door was closed, and now you've got a garage fire. So this is a great way we can start a lot of thoughtful conversation around repair versus replace and what's involved in that. And we can do a lot of estimating exercises in here.
So you basically break these and fix them, break these and fix them?
That's right.
The costs that come with repairing or replacing aren't always easy to figure out. This is where new technology can help, including drones. Patrick Key.
And right now we're looking at what the drone sees, which is damage to several shingles on the roof. This would allow us to assess how many shingles are damaged. In the past, we would have to climb up on the roof, which takes longer to set the ladder up and ensure you have all the safety systems in place. And also for steep or complex roofs, we might actually have to bring in outside resources with special rigging and harnesses and systems that allow them to work safely on a roof like that. That really facilitates moving the claim along and making payment even more quickly.
Gee says so far they've trained over 400 employees to use drones.
And the same smartphone that our claim professionals are using to record audio, video, and imagery, they can also use to fly the drone.
In addition to drones, Guy says they're also using augmented reality. It takes a 360-degree image.
The great thing is it allows us to then have customers actually do that if that's more convenient for them than us coming out and meeting with them on their property. So they can utilize some of these tools, send us some of the imagery, and we can help adjust their claim from afar, not necessarily on site.
There's also a catastrophe operations center where they monitor severe weather and other situations around the globe.
Let's say if a fire's occurred and we might not have access to the area, we can actually begin estimating the property damage based on available real estate records, satellite or geospatial imagery, and actually begin the process of helping estimate for our customers what it might take to rebuild their properties.
And those pics we post on social media, those also become an important source of real-time data during natural disasters.
So you have a tornado. People start uploading images of damage from the tornado even before official access is granted to the area. So we can actually recreate, in essence, the tornado footprint very early on in the process to understand how far it went and how wide it was and what the degree of damage was from that storm system.
Smart home technology is also aiding in this evolution, as will some of the latest features on smarter, tech-enabled cars. We're now inside Traveler's Automotive Test Lab, a room of cars with various kinds of damage. He points to a luxury SUV.
That has lane departure warning systems.
Ben Johns.
Collision systems. It shoots holograms at the windshield when you're about to hit something. It'll vibrate the left side of your seat when you cross one line or the right side of your seat when you cross the other. So we want to make sure we're exposed to all this technology, how it works, but also the cost behind the repairs when these are damaged.
Patrick Guy.
We do believe over time the sensor systems will reduce accidents and the severity of accidents. And as that technology improves more and more, that'll become more and more pervasive. That'll be a very positive thing. But haven't quite seen that play out yet, despite the degree to which many vehicles now do carry the sensors. And we believe a lot of that is due to the fact that we are more distracted than we were before, whether it's interacting with the complexity of the vehicle or whether it's unfortunately interacting with our smartphones, etc.
Something else they're working on here, how to use AI to assess what it takes to fix a car after an accident.
Imagine if you as a consumer could just take a few photos of your vehicle and then have those assessed in with a high degree of reliability. We could estimate the degree of damage, what it's going to take to do the repair. Right now, what the team is doing is they're working with a lot of the vehicles here in the laboratory, and they're taking photos of the vehicles. Those photos are being run through this artificial intelligence system, which has been built very specifically to assess not only the damage you can see, but based on the damage you can see, the damage that might be behind that.
Technologies are pushing the industry forward, but they also create trails of data. What does it mean for consumers? Is there a cost to this convenience? And if so, is it to our pocketbooks, our privacy, or something else?
No matter what it is, the business of insurance is very simple.
Again, The Wall Street Journal's Jeffrey Rogo.
They take big blocks of people, and they figure out when bad things are going to happen, and then they price risk around it. They're literally calculating the day that you're going to die. Unlike hedge funds or private equity or a lot of other really fancy things on Wall Street that most people don't ever touch, everyone touches insurance, from a pauper to a prince.
It's an industry that's growing with many new startups entering the space.
Ultimately, you need a huge balance sheet to make this work. You can get 2 and 3 and 4 year periods wrong as long as you're getting 30 and 40 year periods right. You can also have a big pickup in disasters. This year's a good example. If you had started a catastrophe insurance company this year, you would have had Hurricanes Harvey, Maria, and Irma. You would have had two massive wildfires in California all in the same year. That could wipe you out if you don't have a big enough balance sheet. So for insurance companies, it's tough to start because you need so much money in case the worst case scenario happens to you right away.
It's a huge barrier to entry, but companies with deep pockets and large data operations are making a go of it.
They can get huge chunks of data and find opportunities that maybe a traditional insurance company can't find, both finding new data and using the data that's out there and parsing it differently. And they can find opportunities that maybe traditional insurance company wasn't able to find. And so ultimately, there are other data companies that are coming into this insurance business that are looking at you and your information more than anyone ever has in the past and parsing it in different ways. And so we've just entered this world where insurance companies and the technology firms and the hedge funds and everyone who's coming into insurance has more data at their fingertips than ever before and is parsing it in new and interesting ways, and in those ways, they're hoping to find opportunities.
But is the privacy trade-off worth it? In an age of unlimited data, who draws that line between what's public, what's private, and how to use or not use that information? As we report this piece, New York State is moving to bar insurance companies from asking about your job or education.
The New York decision is incredibly important. They're not the first state to ban companies from asking about occupation education, but New York is probably the most important regulator in the country, and a lot of other state regulators are going to look at what New York did and ask questions. There is all this data that's now available, and regulators are going to have to ask, is it okay for an insurance company to look at this data? Is it okay for them to get this data and choose your rate on it? And what New York decided is, you know what? It is not okay for insurance companies to ask what you do for a living. Their worry is this going to make poor people pay a higher rate than they would otherwise? And if that's the case, they don't want insurance companies to do it.
It's one of many things insurance companies and regulators are wrestling with. But Rogo says, if you think about it, it's what this industry has always done.
There was a time when they had to say, how are we going to insure cars? Cars didn't exist, insurance did, and then all of a sudden we had to figure out how are we going to insure these non-train, non-horse-pulled carriages, and they figured it out. It was bumpy in the beginning, no pun intended. It's the same thing here. The future of everything is coming. We have new homes that are going to be smart homes. We have driverless cars. We have who knows what else.
Though for a time, it means companies are going to have to predict a price off a history that doesn't exist.
And it's going to be difficult, and things may be overpriced in the beginning, but eventually things normalize, and they create opportunities for innovation for the insurance companies themselves. And that's what you're going to see. You're going to see insurance companies take risks. They're going to partner with the smart technology companies, and it'll be a bit tricky, but eventually we'll get to where we need to get.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. The show is produced by Laura Sim and Martha C. Daniel. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Jeffrey Rogo, Leslie Sism, Nicole Friedman, Nikki Blazina, Parminder Bahra, Larry Root, Jennifer Hicks, Dennis Berman, and Mike Miller. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong from the Newsroom in New York.
So I'm going to let these guys load the cannon, and I'll explain a little bit. So they're going to launch this at 34 miles per hour, which simulates a 110-mile-an-hour hurricane. So this is
charging.
Some jacked-up test.
And...
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.